Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. President Trump's signature legislation, that one big beautiful bill, yep, that's its name, is crawling its way through Congress. Having passed the House by just one vote, the BBB is in the Senate where various Republican factions, the fiscal hawks, the centrists, the populists are divided over how to resolve their many competing priorities over the national debt, Medicaid, and tax cuts, to name a few. What's driving these ideological differences among Senate and House Republicans? What role has Trump played and will he play in continuing to lobby Congress? And will this move fast enough to be on the president's desk by July 4th? Spoiler alert, it's not going to be on his desk by July 4th. I put all these questions to Chief Washington Correspondent for the news site Puck, Leanne Caldwell, who has her ear to the ground on all these questions and many, many more. Leanne has covered Congress for years and is, I think, one of the best in the business. By the way, we spoke on Wednesday, June 4th, so as the Musk-Trump breakup was beginning, but before it burst out into the full view, driven in part, it appears, over Musk's opposition to the big, beautiful bill. In other words, we started this conversation before Musk-Trump reached its real boiling point in the recent days. But even with Musk's vocal calls to oppose the BBB in its current form, I still think the calculus for congressional Republicans and how they're thinking about this vote hasn't changed all that much. I do still think that Donald Trump gets the upper hand. But let's listen to this conversation with Leanne Caldwell about how we got here and where things are expected to go. Leanne Caldwell, thank you so much for coming on and joining me.
Amy, I'm so happy to be here. So happy to hear your beautiful voice.
That is very sweet. I am so happy to have the expert, I'm going to argue, the expert on all things Capitol Hill with me as we're watching this big, beautiful bill, right?
Yeah. BBB.
I was worried I was forgetting an adjective. The big, beautiful bill making its way or stumbling its way through Congress. And we're taping this on Wednesday, June 4th. So obviously, there is a lot that could change between now and when we put this up on air, but I'm hoping you can give us some perspective here about what's really going on in the Senate. We're hearing a lot of voices on the Republican side complaining about this. We also just got a CBO score this morning, which indicates that this is actually
worse,
going to add trillions to the deficit. And I would love to get you to just give us a sense of where things stand and how you think things start to play out.
Oh, where to start, Amy? So let's just start with the premise that I actually am one of those people who thinks that this will get done.
As am I.
That it will pass. And the question is, in what form it passes and how painful it is to get there. So Let's just take a step back here and kind of look at the different factions within the party, because that's something that's never changing. And it's something that has been quite consistent and is showing itself again in this bill. So on the one hand, you have the moderate / centrist Republicans who are arguing for one thing. And then, of course, on the other side, they're competing against the fiscal hawks who want another thing, which, of course, is steeper spending cuts. And then increasingly so, especially in this bill, you have like this new faction of the Republican Party, which are the populists in the party. And they're, even though they're quite conservative, they are siding mostly with these like centrist moderate Republicans. And so the challenge, of course, for any leader or speaker, this time it's Leader Thune, is to make them all happy. Because as we all know, they can only lose 3 Republicans in the Senate. And while they all might not be happy at the end, he at least has to make them hold their nose and vote for this bill.
Right. It also seems, and Leanne, you know this better than anyone, that there is real concern and then there's posturing, right?
Yeah.
People trying to, who are likely to vote yes, but need to publicly look like they are fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
So if you look at some of the people that are the most vocal in their opposition or their frustration, we have Ron Johnson. Josh Hawley, the senator from Missouri, wrote an op-ed basically saying Medicaid cuts are a disaster. Rand Paul, who's always frustrated by any spending bill. And then there are folks that we know are more centrist who've been incredibly quiet, like Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska and Susan Collins from Maine. So when you look at the list of potential holdouts, who's real and who's maybe easier for Thune and the president to get back on board?
Yeah. So let's talk about the more difficult ones.
Okay.
And that is Senator Rand Paul first.
Right.
There is no way he is voting for this bill.
Can we just assume he's a no?
Yes, he's a no. There is nothing. I mean,
there's nothing they can do. Yeah.
Donald Trump's Truth Social criticizing Rand Paul and saying, why is he even here? He's just a senator of no. I mean, yes, let's be real. He doesn't vote for anything.
That's his entire brand is senator of no.
Yes, entire brand. So, I mean, he is making very valid points that the bill would increase the debt limit, the debt ceiling, the nation's borrowing limit by $4 trillion. Like that is more than it has ever been increased at any one time. And something that Republicans would absolutely never, ever, ever do under a Democratic president. So the thing about Rand Paul is at least he's consistent, but he's not voting for this bill.
Right.
Although Donald Trump did give him a call, which was quite interesting, didn't seem to change his mind. And then you have Ron Johnson, who is someone who is very cantankerous, who usually does not give in to political winds. He really dislikes Republican leadership. He's better with John Thune, but he just, you know, he's still mad about his first election in 2000 and was it 16 or 14? Amy, I think it was 16. Yeah, it was 16 when...
Well, people basically abandoned him.
Yeah, the Republican establishment.
And sort of left him for dead.
Yes.
Politically, yeah.
And then he beat Russ Feingold.
Yep.
He's still not over that, Amy. So anytime...
I know plenty of other members who hold on to those grudges and they will hold on to them till the day they die.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So he's got that. And he ran as like this.
He
ran as like a deficit cutter.
Yeah, he did.
That has been his whole brand too. Yeah.
Totally. And so he's continuing on that with this bill saying, look, it does not, despite what Speaker Mike Johnson in the White House says, it does not help the deficit. It makes it worse. So there's that. I think that Ron Johnson could be a no vote on this in the end. I do not think he would be the vote to tank the bill, though. But if he has the room in the space to vote against it. I think he will. But he is going to try to get whatever he wants in the meantime. He was also really obstinate during the 2017 Trump tax cut bill. He really held out until he got some demands on pass-through tax business entities, which you all can Google to help explain it to you. But he eventually came around, but he was a freshman senator then with a less distinct brand. So there's that. And then you have Senator Josh Hawley, of course, who is someone who, you know, I just wrote a piece about this. And he is someone who is using this moment to really carve a lane for himself in this like populist vision of the Republican Party. He is no longer crowded out by J.D. Vance, who has left to be vice president, and even Marco Rubio, who was starting to make some of those things when he was a senator. Now Josh Hawley, who everyone thinks is contemplating a 2028 presidential run, this is like his reemergence onto the scene, especially after the very disastrous January 6th like episode where his fist was in the air and he still led the fight to overturn the elections even after the riot at the Capitol. So this is very politically important for him and his brand and his being and his political future, he thinks. Okay, so there's those people who are going to be the loudest. And then to get to your original question, the ones who are less loud, and that is, yeah, Senator Susan Collins. She has a state, Maine, with a lot of Medicaid recipients. And she's really worried about cuts to that. And she is someone, though, who works very much behind the scenes and tries to change the aspects of the bill. And then Senator Lisa Murkowski is someone who has been getting a lot of heat from Republicans and the president, but continues to speak her mind and say how much she disagrees with this administration on a whole host of things. Alaska is another state with a lot of Medicaid recipients, and she is someone who is known to put her constituents first. A big reason why she didn't vote to overturn the Affordable Care Act back in the day is because of how many tribes in her state rely on the ACA. And she is very popular in Alaska, even if she is not popular within the Republican Party outside of Alaska. But she is someone who is to watch for sure. And then, of course, there's Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina, with how Amy, you very well know, is up for reelection this year.
Right. As is Collins.
As is Collins, yes.
Right. Those are the only two that are really do have immediate political consequences, right, to think about.
Correct. I think the difference with Collins and Tillis is Collins' brand is like so unique in Maine. And Republicans and Donald Trump and the White House and the administration are so reluctant to attack Collins because they know she is the only Republican that can win statewide in Maine for this seat. And she has been successful over and over again. And as much as she annoys them, they're going to let her do her thing.
Right. So Tillis.
Then Tom Tillis, yes,
is where on this?
Yeah, he's a little bit of a different animal. His big issue is the Inflation Reduction Act, those renewable energy tax credits that the House has set to expire almost immediately. I believe that's next year. So Tillis is really worried about this because North Carolina has become a big leader in renewable energy, especially solar power. When he was Speaker of the House as a Republican legislator in the state legislature, he did a lot to actually help boost and build that industry. And so he does not want to see that industry go away. And he does not want to see the rug pulled out from the industry in his state all of a sudden. Like, everyone's talking about certainty and the ability to plan and how there's no ability to plan in the Trump administration. Well, this like ending tax credits with hardly any notice like messes people's businesses up. So that's what he is very focused on. And so these, you know, that's six people that I just mentioned, and they can't lose all six of those people. And that's where the dynamic comes in.
Right. But at the end of the day, as you said, and I'm with you on this, this is too big to fail. This is the only major piece of legislation that's going to leave the station in the 25-26 legislative calendar. You've got to get it done, right? So if it does make it through, it still has to go back to the House, where you have an equally small margin to work with. What if you had to explain to somebody who isn't as well versed in the parliamentary procedures of the how a bill becomes a law, can you just give a quick overview of what the House will be upset about or maybe be happy with once they get the revised version back from the Senate?
Yeah. So on those Inflation Reduction Act tax credits, there's a lot of people in the House who are hoping that the Senate fixes that and saves them. Not necessarily keeps them in place forever, but at least a longer runway until they are wound down. Yeah, there are a lot of people who are very angsty about that because a lot of this renewable energy development is in red states. The Senate wants to, generally speaking, and the fiscal hawks want to cut more spending in the bill, but it's really hard to see how they do that, especially when you have the Medicaid folks who are demanding even less cuts than what the House did. And so if the bill does not cut more spending, or if it increases spending, you're going to have those fiscal hawks in the House who weren't happy about voting this for this bill because it doesn't cut enough spending in the House. They're going to be very difficult to keep on board. And then, of course, something we didn't talk about is the state and local tax deduction. And to remind the listeners, that is a federal tax deduction to compensate for high taxes in high tax states. It used to be, you can deduct all of your state and local taxes. Now it's just a $10,000 cap on how much you can deduct. Well, the blue state Republicans in the House, so the New Yorkers, New Jerseyites, New Jerseyans, the Californians, they got it up to $40,000. In the Senate, there are zero blue state Republicans in the Senate. And so they don't care about this. But so that's going to be something that I'm really going to be watching, because this is absolutely a red line for a lot of House, you know, the New Yorkers and Californians. And if the Senate doesn't keep it, it's also an expensive provision. If the Senate doesn't keep it, it's going to be really difficult when it goes back to the House. Now, the goal is to make as few changes as possible, and then for the House just to take up the Senate bill so it doesn't have to keep going back and forth until they have the exact same thing. But yeah, that's a lot of dynamics to deal with.
The idea that this gets done before July 4th seems fanciful. Is that possible?
So it is impossible for it to be on the president's desk before July 4th, which is what Speaker Johnson wanted. I do actually think it's possible for the Senate to pass something before July 4th, perhaps. Maybe. It depends on who you ask. Everyone I ask this question to has a different answer. So, you know, they want to do it as quickly as possible, because the quicker you do it, the easier it is to pass it. But also there's that debt limit situation that there's a deadline of about August-ish, and they don't want to push it up against that. So we'll see.
Right. So then you have a debt ceiling fight on top of a fight over spending and taxes, and that becomes even less fun for the leadership.
The debt limit is part of this bill, which is why Rand Paul hates it. But the closer it is to the debt limit, then the conversation becomes about the debt limit, which Republicans don't want to draw attention to the fact that they are increasing the debt limit by $4 trillion, as much as Rand Paul is trying to make that the issue, because it's an acknowledgement that this bill is also expensive.
Well, let's talk about that piece of it, too. You know, when you're up on the Hill, you're talking to Republicans behind closed doors, or maybe when they are off the record with you. How many of them are worried that this bill, with not as much the spending, but the cuts to Medicaid, will become a pretty challenging issue in the 26 midterms? And if you look at how Republicans who've been out and about at town halls have been treated by their constituents, with Joni Ernst, of course, being the most infamous right now in her town hall getting attacked for what folks in the audience said were cuts that would kill people. Is this something that they're really, truly concerned is going to be a problem?
Yes and no. There are some who are concerned, like Josh Hawley, even though he's not worried. He just won re-election. He's not worried about his own. But, you know, Tom Tillis and Susan Collins.
Right.
And then you have the moderates, the centrists, the swing district Republicans in the House, including Don Bacon, who is very vocal about this, Valadao, Tony Gonzalez. Valadao, of course, in California, Gonzalez of Texas. So yeah, they are absolutely concerned about this. But then on the flip side, you have Republicans justifying it as saying that adding work requirements to Medicaid is something that is very popular, and that if they can message this right, won't be as consequential politically. The challenge is you have Republicans like Josh Hawley, Elon Musk, and others who are pointing out about some of the challenges with this bill and potential cuts to Medicaid. And even if kicking people off Medicaid who are in the country illegally, or people, you know, what they are saying is able-bodied young people who are on Medicaid because they don't want a job, you know, say like those people are removed from the system. That's one thing, but there's other components of the bill that could drastically cut Medicaid. And that is like, I'm going to get a little bit wonky here, but there's this thing called the provider tax. And what it essentially is it is a tax that enables states to get more money from the federal government to pay for Medicaid. So if you take that away, that means that states have less money to pay for Medicaid. And so that's kind of Josh Hawley's and some other people's concern, including Jerry Moran in Kansas. If you take that away, then it's going to be more expensive for states to pay for Medicaid recipients. And so that means that people will get cut from the program. And so Republicans are trying to focus on this one component of work requirements that they say is popular, but there's all these other components of the Medicaid cuts that could have also real impacts that could kick people who, you know, are disabled or who are very poor, who are elderly, off the program that Republicans are kind of mostly ignoring.
Quick break, and we'll be back with Leanne Caldwell. It might be a political odd year, but here at the Cook Political Report, we're as busy as ever. Over the last few weeks, we've rolled out our race ratings for governors, the House, and the Senate. It's not too early to think about next year's midterms, and we have everything you need to know about these races. But it's only available to Cook Political Report subscribers. So don't wait. Join us. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. Leanne, I want to take now a step back and have you weigh in on life in Congress with Trump 2.0. Trump 1.0, you had John McCain and you had Mitt Romney and you had other very vocal sort of, whether we want to call them never Trumpers, but at least folks on the Republican side who were willing to sort of push back on the administration. Now, it seems as if Trump's, the Congress is as Trump-friendly as it has ever been. And I'd love to get your perspective on this and how much of this is Republicans recognizing Trump's influence and power and just accepting that. And how much of it is this is actually a Congress that believes in Donald Trump sincerely, that this isn't just about the politics of Donald Trump, but that this Congress, whether Donald Trump's there or not, is going to act like more like Donald Trump.
So I think it's actually both. And I like the way that you framed that question because I think that that's actually the answer to the question too. Mm. Compared to Trump 1.0, there's a lot more true believers.
Yeah.
But those people have also, many of those people are elected because of Trump, and also many of those people have comported themselves to become more like Trump in order to get elected. And along the way, even if they didn't start out that way, it is like you start to believe your bubble. And so there are a lot more people who believe in the Trump doctrine. There are still many in the party who don't believe the Trump philosophy on tariffs, on international relations, like with Ukraine, and just the isolationism that Trump is pushing. There's a lot of Republicans. That's probably the one of the biggest fissures, I think, in the party still. But there's not a lot they can really do about it. And so they are going along to get along. There's a few Republicans who are vocally and actively speaking out. You have people like Don Bacon, who I mentioned before.
One of three Republicans in a district that Harris carried, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, Harris won that district by 6.5 points.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He can't, like, he needs to break with Trump, yeah, in that district. But then what's interesting is you have these very conservative Republicans who my former colleague at the Washington Post, Paul Kane, dubbed the bluegrass resistance because they're all from Kentucky. You have Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, and Thomas Massey, who have been the most consistent, you know, for McConnell, his like traditional Republican beliefs. And then for Paul and Massey, their libertarian beliefs. And so they are the ones who have been the most consistent in speaking out, but they will see the political ramifications. McConnell, of course, is retiring. But for the most part, people are really worried about their own reelections and their own political viability if they break too much with the president. You know, it's interesting because Chuck Schumer's entire strategy is to try to get Trump's approval rating so low that Republicans have no choice but to break. But it's a strategy that might have worked in 2017. The base is just too vocal and too active and too much in love with Trump to really see that, to enable that strategy to work at this point, I think.
Yeah, I absolutely agree to that. I agree with that. In fact, the challenge for that theory of the case of like his numbers will get so low, Donald Trump's numbers never get so low, right? I mean, even in 2017, 18, 19, occasionally he'd dip down into the low 40s, but he has a pretty steady floor of around 42 to 45%. And that is not enough, especially if you're in a relatively red-leaning state already. That is not enough to quote-unquote scare you to distance yourself from the president. You know, back in Trump 1.0, Leanne, if you went up onto the Senate side and said, okay, show of hands, this is a secret ballot. You could have Trump for the next 3 years, or you could replace him with someone else. You would probably get almost all of the Republican hands to go up to replace him.
Yeah.
What would that count look like now?
That's a great question. I think to replace him, if that the question was, do you want Trump replaced? I actually think if it was secret ballot, no repercussions, and wave a magic wand, I think it might be half the Senate, half the Senate Republicans.
Is it because of his style, the chaos and the he's over here and then he's over there and then he's posting things on Truth Social and we don't really know what he's going to do from moment to moment? Or is it really more ideological and philosophical that this party has gone along on his sort of populist, isolationist journey, but they are eager to get back to their roots?
I think it's the latter. I think it's that. It's like thinking about the tariffs, thinking about Ukraine, thinking about, you know, Pete Hegseth at the Defense Department, and a lot of fear that, you know, I was told that a big reason Republicans are not really pushing back a lot against Pete Hegseth is because they're actually more worried about who the replacement would be, that it would be even a more isolationist person at the Pentagon. And so I think it's more that the corruption of Trump is like baked in. The chaos is well known. The worries about the economy and the impact of like his economic policy and kind of the removal of NATO and the reordering of the world order essentially is what would drive that
break. Lane, I want to switch gears to talk about the Democrats for a minute. You wrote a piece about Hakeem Jeffries sort of his path now. He's got very big shoes to fill in trying to take the job that had been in Nancy Pelosi's hands for years and years and years. How is he viewed from the rank and file Democrats? And if Democrats take control of the House, he becomes Speaker in 27, what would he look like compared to a Pelosi?
Well, it's interesting. When I wrote that story, Amy, I went in with the intention of not doing a Pelosi-Jeffries comparison story. But every single Democrat I talked to, it just like naturally came up. Yeah. They brought it up, and it's impossible to talk about Jeffries without comparing him to Pelosi.
Yeah. I mean, she was an institution there.
Yeah.
And he's the first successor. Yeah.
Right. And I mean, that's what everyone knows. And he's going to be compared until there's a whole crop of people who didn't serve under Nancy Pelosi's leadership. But those are very tough shoes to follow. And people have been saying, we want to give Jeffries time. It takes a while to get your feet under yourself. And Nancy Pelosi wasn't who she was in her first year either. But Jeffries is also on year three. And one Democrat told me, we're fighting a war and we need a general. And Hakeem Jeffries is not a general, especially in this, you know, under the Trump administration, where people feel very panicked and like there needs to be a plan. So there's some good things that Jeffries is doing that people like, that he's trying to be more social first, a social media first, and, you know, play into this like whole authenticity movement that is happening. And that he was able to unite the party in opposition to the big, beautiful bill. And that the party legislatively has been more united since Trump's inauguration. Like, remember the State of the Union, and you know, some people were holding signs, some boycotted, some walked out, some sat and applauded. It was just all of a mess. So the party is progressing in that way, but there's still a lot of frustration that Jeffries is just not aggressive enough against Trump, that he doesn't want, as he's like scared of the confrontation, that Trump kind of considers him to be a non-factor. You know, Trump really feared but also respected Nancy Pelosi. And Democrats are looking for that sort of leadership. They say that while it was good that everyone was united against the big, beautiful bill, it was very, very painful behind the scenes, I'm told, to get the messaging, to get the leader to give Democrats a plan to tell rank and file members what to do. Mm-hmm. He's trying to move away from this hierarchical, top-down Nancy Pelosi way of governing, which people appreciate to some extent, but in big moments like this, they really were craving some direction and it was really lacking. And that's what's really concerning to people, to Democrats in the House anyway.
Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, Republicans, one of their arguments, and I'm sure we'll hear it a lot more in 2026, but one of their arguments for why Republicans need to keep the House, especially to their donors, is that if Democrats win, within 10 minutes, they're going to impeach Donald Trump. And they obviously did twice when he was president in his first term. How serious is that? I mean, do you just assume that if you have a divided Congress in 2027, it's literally going to be the House investigating, impeaching, and then the Senate backing up Trump?
Well, that seems to be the precedent, right? I mean, not only when there was Trump, and then with Biden, you know, Republicans were talking about impeaching Biden. Mike Johnson put a stop to that.
That's what I'm wondering is, like, is it worth it? You know, now the resistance of 2025 feels very different from that of 2017 and 18.
You know, it is not something that leadership is actively thinking about right now. And they're not really laying the groundwork either. They're not writing letters. They're not opening their own internal investigations. They're not preparing for that moment. Mm. And so all the writing on the wall is, despite some of the demand in the fight, the demand from a few Democrats and some in the base that should be the next option. If they win back the House, if they're thinking about that, they're not doing anything about it.
Right.
This stuff takes, like, Nancy Pelosi was setting up in those 2 years, like, they were investigating and they were doing the work, and leadership is not doing that right now.
Right. And they pushed back on at least a couple of members who said, let's put articles of impeachment out now, right?
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
With the thought that what they need to show is that they're doing something substantive instead of just a knee-jerk response to everything that Donald Trump does.
Yeah. And, you know, you're like giving me a story idea because.
Good. I'm glad I can help.
Thanks, Amy, because it's also Donald Trump's all of the, like, the conventional wisdom during the 4 years that he wasn't in office is that all these court cases and indictments was going to hurt him, and it only helped him. And so I do wonder, which I haven't asked this question specifically, but I do wonder if that is playing into their theory of the case as to how it could actually backfire politically on Democrats if they do try to do that, regardless of how corrupt he is. I mean, we also have the Supreme Court, who has said that the president is basically immune from anything. So the only repercussions of any president now is impeachment, and that's almost impossible to do, a conviction anyway.
No, I think that's a really good point, because if you're Democrats and you're thinking about a midterm year, the one benefit Democrats have, at least right now, is enthusiasm. And you don't want to give your opponent's party a reason to feel energized. And you know, part of the reason I think 2018, especially on the Senate side, wasn't as bad for Republicans as it could have been, was the Kavanaugh hearings in October, I think, did wake up a certain percent of the Republican electorate that probably would have sat out the midterms because they were feeling kind of meh. And
such a great point.
The fight over that really inspired them. So that's a really good one too. Leanne, just as we sign off here, I'm curious at what you were thinking about as we go forward. We're looking ahead to, especially over here at the Cook Political Report, the 26 midterms. Mm-hmm. What are the stories that you're paying the most attention to? You think that could have an impact on how things turn out in 26? Basically, what's going on in Congress that is going to be part of the conversation a year from now?
So I think just more generally and broadly speaking, the direction of the Democratic Party is going to play a big role leading into 2026. What do they stand for? You know, even if they don't have a clear leader yet because it's pre-presidential, what other than being against Trump are they? And I think that that's going to be really important, something that Democrats are really trying to figure out. I actually think, and I don't know if this is going to be an issue in 2026 yet, but I think it is going to be a major issue in 2028 is AI.
Yeah, 100%.
And how much, I just think that no one politically is actually thinking about this. And I think that the party that does think about it and plan for it will be in much better shape.
Yeah, especially on the economy. You know, we talk about all these economic indicators and nobody's stepping back and saying, there are people telling us that within 1 to 5 years, the impact on jobs is going to be so immense that it has no comparison in our, you know, like modern history.
I completely agree. And no one is thinking about it.
Yeah.
In that way.
I mean, they're doing a lot of hearings though, right, Leah? I mean, I feel like every time I look at Puck or I look at Punchbowl or others, people are having hearings. There's discussion about it, even in the BBB about AI found its way in that legislation. But it seems to me like they're 10 years behind the conversation, right? They're still talking about regulation as opposed to like its impact on the broader economy and just like the American like social fabric.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. 100%. Like the actual pocketbook issues of how people are going to be impacted by this. That's not what they're thinking about.
Right.
And then, you know, we'll see also who wins in this whole Medicaid fight. Like, will voters be okay with it? Or will Democrats be able to really turn this into a really effective piece? And I'm told that Democrats are really going to try to switch from focusing on Medicaid to healthcare generally, because there's also cuts to ACA benefits in this big, beautiful bill. And so people could lose their ACA coverage, their health insurance. So healthcare is a thing that always plays well for Democrats.
And one that I'm sure we will see them talk a lot about. Leah Caldwell, thank you so much for spending time with us on a very busy day. Well, you're always busy, but this is particularly crazy. So thank you again.
Thanks, Amy. So glad you invited me on.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review or recommend us to a friend. You're our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.